And I'll call the next case, U.S. versus Beck, 092337. Mr. Ruth, I think you're going first.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Rob Ruth, and I represent Corey Thomas in this direct appeal of a conviction for bank robbery. The issue in this case is, was it error for the trial court to preclude evidence of the government witness's motive to lie? The first prickly issue in this case is the question of standard of review. There are two choices. It's either de novo, if you find that it's a confrontation clause violation, or it's abuse of discretion if you find that it is not a confrontation clause violation. There's one critical factor that you have to consider when you're evaluating the confrontation clause. The issue with the confrontation clause is core value or peripheral concern. If it's a core and it's not considered a core value if you're generally, it's not considered a core value if you're permitted to ask the questions to a point but then eventually cut off. Motive to lie, though, is a core value of the confrontation clause. The key fact that you have to understand here, this has been painted somewhat by the government as, okay, she let them ask questions about the gangs up to a point, and then she cut him off, so it's a peripheral concern. But that's not actually accurate. The point wasn't to ask questions about the gang. The point wasn't to show he's in a gang, he's a bad guy, don't believe him. The point was to show the connection between the gang, the rules of the gang, the hierarchy of the gang, the reality of the gang, and how that creates a motive to lie. And that's where we were cut off. So we got some initial question in you're in a gang. The gang robs and steals, yes. And you were part of that gang. And Liggins was a part of that gang, yes. Okay, well, we haven't even got there yet. We haven't got to our questions about motive to lie. And it was that question about motive to lie, that's where the objection was inserted, and that's where we were cut off. So it does and did, in this particular case, affect the core value of the confrontation clause. We were cut off at the knees before we even got started in our cross-examination on this particular witness's motive to lie.
Yeah, but the big question and the big issue that you had on the motive to lie was the fact that Beck failed to bail him out of jail. And it was very clear you were able to get all that out, his anger.
True.
And so I understand in the big picture you would have liked to have gotten more into this theory about the gang and the motivation, but sitting in jail, waiting to be bailed out, making all those phone calls, thinking he was going to be bailed out. I mean, that's
all motive to lie, Your Honor. And that's another angle that the government has taken in this case, is say, look, they got to ask about some motives to lie. They just didn't get to ask about this one. Yes,
Counsel,
Your
Honor. You've discussed the difference between an evidentiary ruling, and which invokes the abuse of discretion standard, versus a violation of Sixth Amendment rights of confrontation, which permits us then to make a de novo review of the record in that regard. There was a great deal of discussion, both at sidebar and then at the briefs, regarding the ruling for the court, the basis for the court's ruling that you couldn't make, you didn't have a good faith belief that you could tie up this testimony you thought you were going to get regarding, or the questions you wanted to ask regarding a motive to protect the hierarchy of the gang. I'm not sure I know how to even ask the question on what the answer is, but what's the relationship between that evidentiary ruling, you have to have a good faith basis to ask a question, and its Sixth Amendment implications?
Okay, Your Honor. That is, once you get past the question of peripheral or core value, that is the heart of the case.
Let's assume this is a core value.
Okay. Here's our foundation. Okay.
I guess what I'm saying is the evidentiary rule of a good faith belief, which is a rule of evidence subject to abuse of discretion. How is that implicated in determining whether or not a Sixth Amendment core value right of confrontation has been violated? Is that also a requirement is that grafted into making a ruling cognizant that you may be running afoul of the Sixth Amendment?
Okay. Well, yeah, that puts a little different spin on it. And I guess I haven't thought about it in those precise terms, but I'm not sure that's what happened, Your Honor, because what the judge never made that finding. Remember, it came up, the government said they don't have a good faith basis.
It's not really addressed in your papers, and it's something I thought of in reading them and then reading it again. Maybe said another way, could a judge foreclose a Sixth Amendment right of confrontation on the basis that the proponent of the question hadn't made a showing of a good faith basis?
Well, I'm shooting from the hip here, but I think that if we didn't have a proper foundation, we lose.
I see.
And I haven't thought of that in terms of, I mean, confrontation clause or not, you have to have a good faith basis. You have to have a foundation to even get through the door.
And part of your problem, though, was you tried to establish something with Simmons because he was asked by the defense whether the robbery was for the purpose of the gang. And he said no, right?
No, that's not quite what happened, Your Honor. The foundation that we laid was this, and the government has actually twisted that fact a little bit out of shape. I pressed him. I asked him the question that you're in this gang, and this gang is about robbing and stealing. And he said, no, that's not what we're about. That's just what we did. Okay? So, and I asked him that question in a couple different ways, and that's what he wanted to bicker about. He wanted to bicker about whether they were about that or that's what they did. It's purely semantics. That Mr. Simmons admitted that the gang robs and steals. But he wouldn't agree that that was the purpose of the gang or that was the gang about. But he did concede. It's very clear in the record, it's in my brief, that Mr. Simmons said the gang robs and steals. His exact quote was, that's not what we were about, that's just what we did. So we did establish, here's the foundation.
So for example, you couldn't give the names of any of these higher up gang members that were under your theory were involved in the robbery to bank. That wasn't made an offer of proof to the court,
well,
was it? In order to further ask this, because your theory was that these higher ups had either directed it or they were the ones that did it. I mean, you didn't specifically give the court any names of any of these higher ups, did you?
We did give two names, Your Honor, and we did the best we could. I mean, of course, I didn't happen to have a hidden camera to record this conversation beforehand, but there were two names, George, and you recall George was the very first phone call that Mr. Simmons made. And he admitted that that phone call was to George. Now, the government made an awful lot of hay out of the fact that the next phone call was to Beck. And they said, look, you call your co-conspirator. You call your accomplices. That was their point. Well, the first call was to George. What do we know about George? Mr. Simmons acknowledged, I don't remember, maybe it was Liggins or Simmons, one of them acknowledged that George was with them on the gambling trip, the week-long gambling trip, that they took before the robbery. The government submitted they all said they were broke. They went gambling in Indiana and they came back broke. The government said that's the motive. That's their motive for this robbery. So George is on the gambling trip. George is broke. George has the same exact motive. So then, in I believe it was the third phone call, there's this reference to Big Bro. And he said, and basically the nature of the conversation is between Simmons and Beck. Beck tells him, I'll tell Big Bro. Beck says, I'll tell Big Bro. And Simmons responds, all right. Now, at trial, though, now who's Big Bro? I don't know his real name. Is it George? I don't know. But there's two different people here that are being connected to this. And remember, what's the name of this gang? The Brothers of the Struggle. And there's Big Bro. That sounds like a person in the gang who has stature. That sounds like a person who is high up in the gang. So
but he didn't know who he was, right?
Pardon?
Simmons didn't know who he was.
Well, he seemed to know who he was in the phone call.
Right.
At trial, he denied it. Just like at trial, Liggins denied even being a part of the gang. Liggins denied even knowing people in common with Simmons. Simmons, of course, testified that Liggins is a part of the gang, and that they do have friends in common. So, look, you know, here's the situation. We've got...
Now, you know you're in your rebuttal time. You can finish up, but...
I'll finish up this thought. And yes. Here's the situation. We have two witnesses who The first witness waits before he turns on Beck and Thomas. He waits until the government tells him, the prosecutor tells him, who he thinks did it. He admitted that at trial. She told him who he thinks did it. He flips, gives him that story. The next guy comes along, doesn't say a word, other than to lie about his name, doesn't say a word until he reads all of Simmons' police reports. Finds out exactly what Simmons says. Now he tells his story. Thank you.
Mr. Cornea.
May it please the court, counsel. I have a bit truncated argument here on the issues, but I do want to stress a couple of points that I think Mr. Ruth stressed as far as the argument he was making. And that's primarily, there was evidence presented, other names presented during the presentation of my defense. And I think that's in the transcripts. That said, I want to address the issue of the 404B objections that I made in regards to Aaron Graff, the PO, testifying. As you know, there's the four prongs that a court needs to look at and whether or not to allow the testimony. And I don't think the third and fourth prong apply in this case particularly. But the real question is, that what's the purpose of introducing this evidence? Well, the government argued that this was the purpose to establish that Mr. Beck used a particular telephone or had a particular telephone. And I can understand that. The problem with that is that she is his PO, and the person who actually owns the phone, Kayla King, was also called to testify that Mr. Beck had this telephone.
But here's the big hurdle you have on this, is you have the waiver hurdle to get over, because it was defense counsel that brought out, it was a testimony from Graff hinting at her role as a probation officer.
Well, she was already told that she was a probation officer. And so in the dynamics of a trial, what do you do? Do you try to use the situation to your best advantage?
The record is a little fuzzy. I think, though, is this correct? At sidebar, the U.S. Attorney, the Assistant United States Attorney, said that they did not intend to disclose the identity of the witness as a probation officer, but only to question her regarding the phone number and the like.
Right.
And then when the trial court judge, over your objection or defense lawyer's objection, said, I'm going to let that go in, then the government did introduce during direct examination the fact that she was a probation officer. Is that correct?
I think that is...
Is that factually correct?
Mm-hmm. I believe that's correct, yeah.
I think it's unclear from the record, too. Yeah.
But you know, the point was... and
because you go on to say in your papers that once that was disclosed, that you felt you had to try to rehabilitate it the best you could by showing that he had been a good probation candidate or something.
Yeah, and I didn't want to waive the
but
issue.
But factually, is that correct? Was that disclosed on direct examination?
My memory is... And I don't have the transcripts in front of me, but my memory is that it was disclosed that she was a probation officer. They didn't say that she was Beck's probation officer, but we're dealing with a jury that's, you know, they're not a bunch
of
stumps.
Is it also true that at the original sidebar colloquy that the government said they did not intend to introduce that fact originally?
I believe they did say that, yes. And then when I persisted with my objection, that came in. And at that point, I think the dynamics changed, and now there was some stuff that I could pull from Ms. Graff that I thought or hoped could help my client, in that he had contact with her, that he had permission to travel to Chicago. You know, he was down in Chicago the day of the May 9th robbery or coming back that morning. I mean, so there was information that I could use, but I think... So I had to kind of reevaluate the whole defense at that point.
So did you understand when you left the sidebar that the government was going to reveal on direct that she was a probation officer?
That was my understanding, yeah.
All right. And so was there any discussion in sidebar that perhaps she could be referred to as just a government agent so that the jury wouldn't know that she was a probation officer?
No, there was no discussion about that at sidebar, as whether or not she was a government agent.
Was there any discussion at sidebar about this alternate source? I guess you said a subsequent witness had that same information.
Yeah.
Was
discussed? I brought up to the judge that the government had Kayla King there to testify. She could testify that she gave Prince Beck this telephone, that he used it, and...
The trial court judge was aware of that alternate source of
evidence.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Ben, couldn't it have worked to just let the probation officer indicate that she was an agent of the government, an employee of the government, and that she was familiar with the him having the phone? Or you think that that would
I think the cat's out. I mean, the jury's...
No, I mean, if the jury hadn't known that, if she had been identified as a government of the agent, when the government brought out indirect, she was a government of the agent. And during the course of her duties, she learned that he had a number or whatever, that, you know, part of her responsibility is to get phone numbers. I mean, they could have thought she was an agent of, I don't know, the FBI or whatever. But that was a way that you could have cross-examined her on the fact that she was a government agent.
And then that could have been done that way, I suppose, Your Honor, although at the time I don't think that occurred to any of us, although we may have worked that out. But the fact of the matter is, over my objections, this testimony was allowed. It was prejudicial to my client, and it changed the dynamics of the trial.
Was there did you ask any kind of instruction to be given that they are not to consider the fact that she's a probation officer in any way? Did anybody request it?
No, not that part. I mean, it came down to the issue of how much do we want to really focus on this issue, I think a lot of attorneys will say you put in the jury instructions that just highlights it all over again.
At the time the testimony was given.
Actually,
was there an instruction to the jury
to
consider what her position? Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Altman. So why don't we start with this point? Was it clear that the government was going to bring out what she did, and was that brought out in the direct testimony?
It was.
I'm sorry, but is it also true that originally, did you try the case, counsel?
I did.
Did you represent that you weren't going to bring out her office?
No.
During the colloquy?
No, we said we were.
During the colloquy you said
yes,
that?
Yes. The transcript, Mr. Sinnott, my co-counsel, indicates this next witness is a probation officer with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. She is Mr. Beck's probation officer. I put her in for the purpose of establishing that the relevant phone number is a phone number that Mr. Beck gave her. I have no intention of going into the fact that Mr. Beck was on probation. We're going to bring out that she is a probation officer, and in a professional capacity, Mr. Beck gave her a phone number as a phone number to reach him at, and I just want the record to be clear.
I see. And then, not to interrupt you, but then during direct examination, was it made clear that she was Mr. Beck's probation officer?
No.
I see.
No, the question was asked, you're a probation officer, correct. Do you know him? I do. Do you see him? I do. Identify him. Did Mr. Beck provide you in your professional capacity with a phone number for you to call when and if you needed to reach him? Yes.
Okay. I see. That's pretty strong inference, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the jury's, it's not rocket science for the jury to put two and two together.
But
it's his
professional
capacity. The only profession she has is as a probation officer. So
it could have been a family member's agent, someone else that needed to reach him for another purpose. I mean, we were very careful about it. That's why we fronted it with the grand jury. We offered to stipulate to it as well.
You offered to stipulate to the phone number or
to the
fact or her identity and that she would testify?
We offered to stipulate that was a phone number that he was using at the time in question.
I see. And the defense rejected that stipulation.
Correct. He had several phone numbers, and that would be speculation. And that's the reason why we needed someone important to say that this was a phone number.
What about the next witness?
First of all, the phone was in her name. She did say she gave it to him to use, but she also said that many people used the phone, and at some point the term community phone got attached to the phone.
Would she say she gave it to him within the relevant time frame?
She said he was using it during the relevant time frame, but that many other people were also using it during the relevant time frame.
I see.
It has unlimited minutes, and so I would call it, and sometimes he would answer, and sometimes other people would answer. That phone was used to make a pretext phone call the morning of the bank robbery. So we needed to tie it to Mr. Beck. We offered to stipulate. They said no. We needed to show that someone of authority, someone important, this is the number he gave to someone important.
Right, and so that's why I don't understand why it was never raised, the idea to just say that she's an employee of the government, an employee of the state of Wisconsin, is part of her responsibility. She collects phone numbers. She met with him in that capacity. She got his phone number from him. Why couldn't that have worked? That would have shown she was a person of authority.
It could have, but it also, without going into some explanation, could have shown that she was someone who collected information for, I don't know, dietitians or something. I mean, it didn't show.
All she has to do is say it's part of her official duties to collect these phone numbers, and he was one of the people that she had to collect it from. But I mean, that way you have the fact, the whole point you have that it's an authority, and you someone employed by the state of Wisconsin. I'm just saying that's an alternative when you have this kind of hot button issue, because the jury clearly knew he was. I mean, unless they were just weren't thinking, they could put two and two together and know. And then there was no. Did you ask that the court instruct them that this that they're not to consider the fact that she's a probation officer in deciding this case at all?
We didn't, because immediately after the direct questioning, Mr. Beck's attorney brought out that she was his probation agent. So at that point, there wasn't much else we can do. And just to touch on one other thing, I would submit that just because it's some random state employee's job to collect phone numbers doesn't mean that Joe Citizen is going to think that they always get correct phone numbers or that they always get accurate phone numbers or that Joe Citizen would recognize the importance of giving someone their correct phone number.
Did the defense offer any evidence to rebut that?
What?
That the defendant had the phone during the relevant time with that number?
He did. I believe that one of the defendant's girlfriends said, I think that she had the phone at the time or that she saw someone else with the phone at the time.
So it's your theory that not only the testimony but the authority of the person testifying was necessary to give it the appropriate weight?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I see.
And our final position on that would be that should the court find that it was error, first of all, if it was error to allow it, it was compounded by the defendant's questioning that it was his probation officer, which, again, the government didn't get into. But should it have been error to be admitted at all, it's the government's position that pursuant to United States versus Taylor, it was harmless error. Could it have been done more artfully? Perhaps. Was it fatal? No.
And why was it harmless?
Because there was other testimony about Mr. Beck being in jail at the time, which certainly disclosed the presence of a criminal record, criminal convictions. Kayla King, the next person who testified about the phone, said, I gave him the phone when he got out of jail. I don't think that this particular witness is the only person who let the cat out of the bag.
And were there any motions by the defense to preclude those witnesses from making reference to the fact that, you know, she gave it to him when he got out of jail?
No. I don't believe so.
Okay.
So with regard to the cross-examination, first of all, with regard to the standard of review, the government submits it is a peripheral issue. The only limitation placed on the cross-examination was questions relating to the hierarchy of the gang structure of the gangster disciples. This court stated in United States versus Smith that a limit to asking questions only about a plea agreement but still providing other opportunity to cross-examine and show bias was a peripheral issue because it did not deny the defendant the opportunity to show that the witness lied. It only limited his ability to add extra detail to that motive, and that's exactly what happened in this case with regard to credibility. As noted, Mr. Simmons, the witness, was asked about his anger towards Mr. Beck for not bailing him out of prison. He was questioned about his plea agreement. He was questioned about wanting a reduction in his sentence. He was questioned about his extensive criminal history. He was questioned about being provided the information by the government. And he was questioned at length about all the lies he told in the course of this investigation.
Counsel, the question that was precluded, would you say that went to a core value implicated by Sixth Amendment rights or peripheral value?
Peripheral value. Definitely peripheral value, because it didn't limit their opportunity to show that he was a liar. They brought that out
everywhere
else.
Motive to protect someone else to the detriment of the defendant would certainly show that he was lying, wouldn't it?
Yes. And the government allowed, the court allowed questions regarding his motive to lie. The court also specifically said...
Well, let me say it this way. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No.
The fact that the court allows some inquiry, does that mean that it can disallow other things that are required under the Sixth Amendment that would also go to the same issue? I mean, you seem to be saying
that... I think so, yes. As this Smith case said, the limit on cross-examination, it didn't deny to show that he's a liar. It just shows one way to show he's a liar. They still had
But if there's another highly probative way to show that he might have a motive to testify falsely, you say a court can preclude that because they've left the defense lawyer interrogate on cross-examination on other reasons to lie?
I think so, yes.
I see.
Yes. And with regard to questioning about whether someone else did it, the district court specifically told the defendants that they could argue that other people did this. She did not shut down that line of questioning at all. She said, you may question whether George or Big Brother did it. You just can't do it this way. So they still had the opportunity to say, isn't it true that George committed this crime with you? Well, the answer would have been no. Well, you're lying to protect him, aren't you? No. She did not shut down that line of questioning by this ruling. And I do want to just touch for 1 minute on the ruling that was made by the district court. She said, but you don't have a good faith basis that anybody else committed these robberies. That was her ruling. The defendants say, yes, we do. My client tells me he didn't do it. There were higher ups. And she says, no. No more questioning along these lines. She doesn't have to restate her reasoning. What they said simply didn't change her reasoning. When you look at it in context, you can tell that that's what the reason was. I was trying to think of something to compare it to last night, and the only thing I could think of was a child says, Mom, can I go to my friend's house? No, you have to do your homework, and it's close to dinner. But, Mom, I want to, and it's going to be really fun over there. I said no. We know that the reasons were because it was close to dinner and they had to do their homework. You don't have to reiterate that when you're not buying the subsequent arguments. And that's what the court did in this case. She said there's not a factual basis. They said but, and she said no. When you look at it in that context, it's clear that that was her reasoning, and that reasoning was sufficient. The defendants didn't argue anything about sentencing. Mr. Beck does make that argument in his brief. If the court has any questions about that, I can answer any questions. Otherwise, I would just respectfully request that the court affirm the convictions and sentences of both defendants.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Mr. Ruth, how much time? 1 minute. I'll give you 1 minute. I'll give Mr. Cornea 1 minute.
I appreciate it. I'd like to make two quick points. But you don't have a good faith basis. That wasn't a statement as much as it was a question. The government said, Judge, they don't have a good faith basis. We had never spoken to that up to that point, and we had not had the opportunity to speak to that. The government says they don't have a good faith basis. The judge turns to us and says, but you don't have a good faith basis. We tell her our good faith basis, and she gives no response. And then it was argued and argued and argued and argued down the line, and she says, no more questions. Completely cut us off. So that wasn't her ruling. It wasn't, but you don't have a good faith basis. I said no. It was, ask the question, but you don't have a good faith basis. We explained our good faith basis, and then a lot of other things happened. A lot of other arguments were made, and then ultimately she completely cut off all questions along those lines. But both of you asked questions about this. Well, you have a motive to lie. You got to ask other questions about motive to lie. Does that trigger this core value? The government would love it if they could dictate the only motives we get to go into. These are your motives, okay? You got to ask those questions. This was the motive. This was the big motive. There were other little ones, but this was the big one.
We understand.
Protect Big Brother. Thank you.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I believe Mr. Ruth and Mr. Cornea, you were both appointed. We thank you for your vigorous representation of your clients. It's a great aid to the court to have lawyers that will represent people who need that representation. We thank you, Ms. Altman, for your fine performance as usual. We'll take the case under advisement.